I've got to say, Oscar came to our little meeting in Yosemite Lakes Park, Coarse Gold, California, and he brought so much AA to us. I could really understand it very much when this man talked. And so I think you're really in for a good, good storytelling that has so much meaning to me and to others who have listened. So Oscar, if you would, please.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Oscar, and I am an alcoholic. Somebody told me to enunciate my words clearly. And I'm telling you bad luck to you, Paul, because I have an accent, and I hope you can read through it. What a pleasure to be here with you. And I'm so grateful to be invited to chair such a special occasion. And our literature and a vision for you talks about that we will be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. In the Spirit of what? Our three legacies talk about the Spirit of recovery, and it's the basis of our entire life as alcoholics. And we are here in the Spirit of service. Thank you so much for working so hard to touch our lives and to do what you need to do with your time. And we are here in the Spirit of unity. And unity is so essential for us. And our reading before about our tradition says that we should stand in unity or most of us will die alone. And that was the truth for me at the time that I got here. There was a saving grace, finally, that was here waiting for me so that I will not die alone. My home group is the Third Legacy Group in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And my sobriety day is August 8th of 1988, and I am eternally grateful for that. My home group believe in being active in our sobriety. We hold each other accountable. We do service with the community. We try to be active with all the different offices in which AA serves the community, whether it's the jails, the hospitals, institutions, and so on. And I'm grateful for those men who are active in showing that this is so essential for us as alcoholics. My story is very simple. You know, I was born in 1954, and I came into this world 3 months earlier, so I was a premature, as if that probably was a pre-designed issue about my behavior, that I could not wait, you know, to do whatever. It's just, I couldn't wait. I wasn't patient enough to wait for the 9 months to come. So I was not cooked completely in my mother's womb. I spent some months in an incubator, and which started another problem that I lived through most of my life, which is my disconnection, not just with God, but my disconnection with other human beings. And it has been this program that through that process that you guys suggest as a program of recovery that has been helping me to establish a connection with you guys and with God. I cannot blame my drinking on my parents. My parents never drank. I never saw them drinking. I can never blame my drinking at the environment when I was a little guy, because I don't have memories of drunkenness around me. But nevertheless, there's a history of alcoholism in my family, especially my paternal side. I grew up in a country, born and grew up part of my life in a country called Honduras. And in 1969, there was a war between Honduras and El Salvador. My dad was a Salvadorian citizen working with a North American company in the north of Honduras. And then we went to my paternal land, which is El Salvador. In there, I was more exposed to the drinking as a young child. I was 15 when I had my first drink, and I remember. But look at the whole thing in retrospective. Before the drinking, there was something else that was more powerful that I was experienced at the time, which was girls. You know, and our literature says that lack of power is our dilemma. And a dilemma is a problem with two equally unacceptable solutions. That's what a dilemma is. And it wasn't just true by alcohol. It was true as a young man, I learned a relationship with the opposite sex. And it was almost like a drug. Okay? I experienced it, and I wanted more. And it wasn't like, I'll leave you alone for now. No, when? And so, there's certain dynamics in my family. I remember one night, and forgive me if I am too blunt about some of my expressions with you. I was making love to myself that night, and my mother found me doing it. And the best way that my mother could handle it is that she began hitting me with her shoes. And every time she hit me, she's telling me that was duty and that God was going to punish me and that I shouldn't be doing that. So in my head is this deal, okay, so he's going to punish me for this, but why did he give it to me if it feels so good, right? A month went by, and then my body took control over the deal, and I am in the night again having these feelings, and I start making love to myself. And then all of a sudden, there is a thunderstorm in my town, and there's thunders everywhere. And at that moment, I'm thinking, holy crap, it's true. And he is really looking for me. And in my mind, I'm picturing that one of those thunders is going to come flying and cut it off. And he's going to be jumping all over the place. So the storm passes and nothing happened. So what happened in my mind is, it's not true. Nothing is going to happen. And for the longest time, I had no belief in God. I had no belief that something was going to happen to me. Okay? So by the age of 15, I tried alcohol for the first time. So I live in this little town in El Salvador called Jiquilisco, and my uncles will drink. And see, you have the mind of as a young man, and it's immature, and it's full of fantasies. At that time, I remember watching Western movies. And what I love about this idea of the Western movies is that the main character always go to the bar. He will have a few drinks. And he will leave that place, and he will never stagger. Nor did he seem affected by the effect of alcohol. And whenever he left, there was a woman begging him not to leave. And he will get on his horse, take off onto the horizon, and never look back. So that idea was really appealing to me, and I will see my uncles always sitting somewhere having alcohol and a woman sitting on their lap. And I think, one day. Until one day, there was one of my uncles saw me going with my friends, and he said, hey, come here. You want to have a beer? I said, no, I don't like beer. I never tried it, but I said, oh, no. So he got this glass of something and gave it to me, and it was hard liquor. And I remember it burned. And I remember it burned all the way to my stomach, but in a few seconds, what happened is this thing took over me. And up to that point, I have felt extremely inadequate in life because having been born premature, I was very skinny. I was taller than most of the kids in my age group, and they would call me nicknames, right? So I remember that I took that thing, it hit my brain, and it did this magical thing. And I was no longer inadequate, I was no longer afraid, and it did the work. And for the longest time, I looked forward to have that feeling, that sensation. So whenever I had the opportunity with friends, we will do that. So I had my friend Nicholas, who was an altar boy at the Catholic Church. And Nicholas will be there with the priest during Mass, and he will tell us to bring a canteen to the back window, and that he will fill it with wine because there was plenty of wine. What I remember is that we'd be waiting for him impatiently for the Mass to finish so we could drink this wine. And we will drink the wine and go down the street where there was an AA meeting. And I remember sticking my head and saying, effing drunks. So I never planned to be here with you guys. Something happened along the way. And here we are in the fellowship of the Spirit. So I began drinking. There were times that drinking was fun. It hasn't taken over my life completely. I remember having trimester test exams in school, and we will study in somebody's house, and somewhere by midnight, somebody will come out with a bottle of vodka or rum. And then somebody else would bring a guitar, and we knew where the girls were studying that night, so we'll go there and serenade. I became a poet in those days at 12 o'clock at night. By the time I got to be 19, life at home was impossible. I could not live with my father's rules, and I had to leave the house. So I had the great idea, the brilliant idea, that if I get married, I'd be a man, and then I could leave my father's house. So I got married for the first time. And I played my role of being the man of the house. A 19-year-old, totally immature, totally independent, I was not dependable. So as a result of that, in my first marriage, I have a daughter who grew up without me because I could not be there for her. I didn't have the maturity to be a parent. So my journey continued with the drinking, and at times the reason why that marriage went to the side is because drinking became more important than me playing the role of the family man. I was still a kid playing in the streets. So I came here to this country. I lived in Berkeley for a long time, and I got married for the second time. And I know that at the time, it seemed like I had fallen in love, but I wasn't. I had fallen in lust. And seemed to be the right idea at the time. But that relationship was full of a lot of anger. It was full of violence. I didn't consider myself a violent man because I wasn't hitting anybody, but I was hitting walls. And I was probably intimidating for the other person. The only reason why I stopped is because one day, in the moment of the anger, I hit the wall and ended up hitting the 2x4 behind the cheek rack and break my knuckles. And that was the end of it. I came to realize it wasn't a good idea. So the relationship was going down And I couldn't stop it because drinking was more important to me. At that time, I was a construction worker working in San Francisco in high risers, and 4 o'clock was always Miller time. We get out, we merge from the job site into a bar along the way before we go home, and he was drinking there until 11 o'clock, and I loved the companionship with those guys. You know, somehow there's a kinship with you guys. And I, for some reason, that was the kind of people I wanted to hang. The only difference is that then I didn't have a true partnership with other human beings the way I have with some of you. And so what happened is that I knew the marriage was over. So in between marriage, I met a girlfriend that is my wife now, and we have been together for 37 years. And this is not something that I take ownership. There is a God, and it's not me, okay? There is a God that is constantly watching me because I don't seem to get it at time. You know, the story of my life is, there is a movie I used to watch with my daughter. My daughter is here, my wife is here. My oldest is 30-something years. I've been sober longer than she has been alive. And through her, I have been able to see my second generation of my blood coming into this world that they don't know anything about me being a drunk. And I'm grateful for that. But I used to watch this movie with her. It's called Hook with Robert Williams. And in that movie, there's this character that every time somebody new come into that house, he would get all excited. And he said, "I lost my marbles. I lost my marbles." And people would just chime him away because they know what he was talking about. Until Hook goes back into Neverland and come back, and somebody give him a bag and said, "Give this to so-and-so." So he come back and give him the bag, and the guy says excited, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I lost my marbles, I did. The deal with me is, I lost my marbles, but I'm not getting them all at once. With you guys, I've been getting one at a time. And sometimes I lose them again, and until I find them again. And what happened is, it's a painful experience of time to get those marbles back. It's humbling experience. I'm not a humble guy. What I have is a series of humbling experiences that bring me to my knees, and the realization of what's going on with me just hit me. In our program, they call it spiritual awakenings. And so I have a series of spiritual awakenings. And if you read spiritual experiences, it says that they are those of the educational variety, okay? So I keep getting those of the educational variety when I come to a realization of things that are happening, stuff that I keep doing. I wish I could report to you that after 30-some years, I get this deal together. If my wife, who is going to be the speaker for Al-Anon tomorrow, were to grade me, I think I would be lucky if I get a C+. Okay? Because sometimes in my best day, I'm still not my best friend. It's not always. So there is this girl that I met in between my relationship with my ex-wife, and at the beginning we had this tremendous friendship. Before we ever got emotionally involved and physically involved, we will go to the laundry mat. She was finishing her master's degree in UC Berkeley, and we will go to the cafeteria and be there until 1-2 o'clock in the morning talking. And she was the first person that I knew that was interested in knowing me as a human being. So she became my friend. She's a good friend to me, probably better than I am to her sometimes. So what happened is that at some point she saw me going down, okay? And I'm living with my mother. And one day she said to me, you know, I like you. I would like to make a life with you, but I cannot do it when you're doing what you're doing. So if you ever get sober, call me. It would have been great if that was the end. She had the brilliant idea to take my mother to an Al-Anon meeting because she had been going to Al-Anon. I didn't appreciate that. Because especially when I come one day at 1 o'clock in the morning, knock on my mother's door and she's not opening. And she's looking at me through the window with tears on her eyes and she said, what do you want, son? I said, I want to come in. And she said, I'm sorry, but you can't. She said, it's hard for me to see you killing yourself in my couch. She said, somebody will tell me that you're dead and I will bury you, but you cannot come in. See, what happened is that at that time, my disease had taken such a control of my life. In 1985, I went to my first treatment center, and I didn't think I belonged there or I belong here with you guys. That was a deal that my union broke with the company that I was working with. In order for me to keep my job, they needed me to go to a 21-day spin drive program. And I went to the 21-day spin drive program and I got my job back. And in the program, in our literature, there's so many things that describe me. And it says there that our problem centers in the mind. And I will get dry, but this thing will be working 24/7. I will wake up and I'll be thinking, oh man, I wish I could. Just one. And I cannot describe to you how many times I paid the price for the false idea that I can just have one. And over again, I found myself in this merry-go-round, spinning down the line. And this woman was willing to spend her college savings to save me. She really wanted to save me. I think that somebody in Al-Anon told her that she was crazy and not do that. You know, AA presents us with so many dichotomies, and so many of those dichotomies are lessons that are we can even fathom at first, because people tell us things and we don't understand it. You guys had such a strange language. When I came here, I'm trying to understand you. Well, surrender to win. I said, what an idiotic idea. What an idiotic idea, surrender to win. Who the hell taught these people that? You know, you talk about spiritual axioms. You know, and it's like, I want no part of that. So I stopped seeing her. Finally, I hit my bottom. I am standing in St. Vincent de Paul in West Oakland in MacArthur Boulevard. And I'm in line in St. Vincent de Paul asking for a plate of food. And I sit on this table where there's only one chair. There's a guy to my right and a guy to my left. And I sat there. And I smell the guy on my right, and he smelled like he hasn't taken a shower for a long time. And the guy on my left smells really bad, too. And he has this runny nose, and his mustache is all over him. And all the time that I have been deeming myself too out here to be there, finally dawned on me that I'm screwed up, that I had no place to go. After that's been dry, I will go in and out of AA. I was your researcher. I did that service for you. I was your researcher. I'll come with errors in my eyes to tell you how messed up it's still out there. I had no peace with me. I had this hole in the soul that there was nothing that could fill it up. Not even the love of my mother, not the love of my family, and nobody. I just had this hole that alcohol was no longer filling in. So I found myself not having a place where to go, and I called this guy who I met in AA. He was in one of my meetings, gave me his business card, and he said, "Oscar, if you ever need help, call me." And I am in East Oakland, looking in my pockets to see if I have a quarter or anything, and I found this business card. And I called him collect, and he took the phone, the call collect, and I said, "Hey, Bill, this is Oscar. Do you remember me?" He said, "Yeah, man, who will forget your accent?" He said, "What's up?" I said, "I can't do this anymore. I need help." So he came around 1 o'clock in the morning, picked me up in East Oakland. He opened the door of his beautiful car that he had, and I'm all dirty, and he said, "Come in, man." And then I'm thinking that he's going to call me or tell me many things about how messed up I am. And what he said to me is, "Hey, thanks for calling me. I'm so glad that you are okay. Come on in." And he took me to his house. He gave me clean towels. He said, "Take a shower." And when I'm taking a shower, he's cooking dinner for me. And after I come out of the shower, he's sitting at the table with me. He feeds me. And he said to me, "How can I help you?" I said, "I don't know what to do anymore, man. I don't know what to do." He said, "You need treatment?" I said, "Yes." So he said, "Okay, sleep in that couch. And give me clean sheets." And I hear him on the phone making a series of calls. And he has this place where I can go. I need to go to detox. I was August 7 of 1988, and August 8 of 1988 was my first day clean and sober. So I went to detox and then went to this program. Okay, so I hit my bottom. And I hit my physical bottom and mental bottom at the time, because there was another bottom that I needed to hit, and was a spiritual bottom. So I went to this program and I lived there for 6 months. But my first 3 months were hell. Because every morning I wake up, I'm thinking about the drinking and the stuff I do in the streets. And every time I go to sleep at night, I'm thinking about the drinking and the stuff I do in the streets. And this guy will come on Tuesday to take me to an AA meeting, and I would say, "Bill, this is what's going on with me." And he will say, "Give it to God." And I had preconceived ideas about God. I wanted nothing to do with God. So, but the torture that was in my mind was so big that after 3 months I knew I was going to go out. And on a Friday, I am contemplated. I'm done. I don't wanna fight this. I just gonna go. So I'm planning my next relapse. What I can tell you is that it was a Friday, and I went to have lunch because I didn't want to leave with the empty stomach. And as I proceed to go into the dining room area, I see the chapel is empty. And for whatever reason, in my head, there's this voice that said, "What do you have to lose? What do you have to lose?" In our program, it says the willingness is the key, right? The willingness, if ever, open the door so slightly, is enough for a lot of us. That's what it says, especially in the third step. It talks about the willingness, okay? So what happened is, I go there, and I kneel down. I don't know what I'm praying to, but I remember saying the most profound prayer I ever said. I remember saying, "I don't know if you hear me. I don't know if you want anything to do with me. I don't know if you're here. But if you are, please help me." And that was it. And I went to eat. I didn't leave the program that night. And it wasn't until 2 days later on a Sunday, I'm brushing my teeth to go to sleep, and it just hit me like a thunderbolt. That for those days, I haven't thought about drinking. I haven't thought about leaving, and whatever it is that was occupying my mind, it was just lifted. In the program, they talk about the obsession of the mind. You know, we are not only physically ill, but we have this obsession of the mind that only a spiritual experience or a sufficient spiritual experience can remove that from us. That's my experience. I cannot tell you how this program works. If you want to find out, the first 164 pages in the big book has the design for living for us. Read it, especially with a sponsor. They can help you understand some of the tricks that are in there. So my mind became open, okay? Something changed. I began paying attention to what you guys were saying. I began paying attention to not be so angry about everything. So my gratitude to you is because you have provided for me a design for living that really works for me. Okay? So this guy became my sponsor, and I remember doing my first step with him. I remember the day. It was a Sunday, and I am in Berkeley with him, and I had done my fourth step, and I'm going to do my fifth step with him. Doing my fourth step, one of the difficult things that I ever done for me, because what happened is, since the time I was a child that I began liking girls to this time, something has possessed me emotionally. Today, I call it my ego, and I didn't want to look bad, okay? Having to take the mask off is terrifying. See, I have to believe that the day I die, my ego is going to be hovering over me, looking at my body, and thinking, "See, that color of shirt is not looking good on you. I don't know what they're going to think of you with that haircut, dude." That's what my ego is going to be doing. I'm dead. Who cares? But my ego does. So I'm doing my first step, and I'm thinking, what is this guy going to think about me? Because if you read our fifth step of our chapter 5, it talks about our resentments, our fears. And for whatever reason, somebody decided to put your sexual inventory on page 69. I don't know if that's a joke, but that's what happened. So I am sitting with this guy, and I had done my step work in those areas of my life. And I have made a list of people, places, and things that I have resentments against, my fears, and my sexual inventory. And I'm having a hard time that this guy is going to hear me out in whatever I've been writing. And North Oakland, there is a little park that is, it was built underneath the bar railroad tracks. And it's a bench, and it's a green area. And he sit down, and I'm having my cup of coffee and my writing. And he said, let's pray. Let's pray that God's will be done ultimately. So I sit there, and I began reading. And I'm embarrassed about admitting some of the stuff. I am expecting that by the time I finish, this guy will be gone. That he would say goodbye, I don't want anything to do with you. And what happened is this miracle happened. There's a grown-up man sitting next to me. He has tears in his eyes. He gave me a hug and he said, thank you for sharing this with me. So when in the book talks about that we had the opportunity to build meaningful relationships are built on the fact that we decide to take the mask and something happened. A true partnership with another human being took place for me that day. So Bill and I were friends until he died. The week before he died, I had been with him. He had cancer that had metastasized in his lungs. We had a conversation, and he said, Oscar, my boy, just stay teachable. Just stay teachable. Stay willing. See, for the longest time, I fought this. I would go in and out because I didn't want to get real with you guys. Because, see, for me, I keep a facade and I keep this lie about me that I didn't want you to know who I really was. Full of fears, full of a lot of stuff, full of inadequacies. And because of that, I did a lot of stuff to cover my tracks. So I didn't want you to know that. You know, I moved here from Oakland, and I found a group of friends that have become my brothers. You know, there's so many faces around this table right now that I know so about you, just the same way you know about me. And it has been a privilege to sit with you and to hear you go through your stuff and for you to hold my hand when I'm going through stuff. See, when I got sober, you guys told me to do what they tell you to do when you board an airplane. And that is fasten your seatbelt because you will experience some turbulence. In a time in life, I had to fasten my spiritual seatbelt and my emotional seatbelt. And my total dependence on God is reflected in my dependence on you because I hold your hand and you hold mine. John is my sponsor. And has been dealing with me for a while, and I still call him. He's a dear friend of mine. I love him. But he pissed me off at times. I have raised four kids in sobriety. Two of my kids did a number on me. See, some of us tried to hold on to all ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely, right? So my idea is that if I don't drink, everything is going to be fine. Happily ever after. Yeah, it's a lie. Because what happened is life happened, and life will hit you. And in the process of going through the pain, I have learned tremendous things about me. So I'll call him about paying this and paying that for stuff that my kids have done, and he would say, oh, yeah, it's just money. My head would go, bullshit, it's not your money, it's my money. But the thing is that every time I took care of it instead of escaping from it, every time I had to face those unpleasant moments, there was a growing process taking place in my life. There's so many things I have faced in life, and there's so many ways in which God has presented himself to me. You know, I was diagnosed with cancer in my face, and I went to Kaiser, and they did biopsies, and they said, yeah, you have cancer. So they arranged a meeting with the guy who is going to perform surgery on me. And that morning, I had been doing my prayers, and I had been saying, okay, God, I don't know what your will is, but I'm here. You're in charge. See, in our book says that we trust infinite God that rather than trust our finite self, right? So I said, so I go meet this guy. He's explaining to me what he's going to do with me. And he said, do you have any questions? I said, no, I surrendered already. He looked at me and he said, whoa, are you one of those guys in the rooms? I said, yeah. He sit next to me and he said, you know, I love you guys. Thanks to you, I have a mother that raised me and it was so loving to me. And I can never pay you for what you did in her life. And he said, don't worry about it. I will take care of you. It's almost as if a hand has come down and said, hey, it's gonna be all right, Oscar. I got your 6 o'clock, man. Don't worry about it. So every moment of anxiety, every moment of challenges in my life, trusting that you guys have been telling me the truth, has taken me to this place where I had this relationship with a power greater than myself. Part of my life now that I'm retired is simple. You know, in Wisconsin, I go to 5-6 meetings a week. I work with a bunch of guys that are always calling me, and I can't get them sober, but God can. You know, it would have been tragic for me to go from the cradle into the grave without having experienced this way of life. It would have been tragic. Dying would not have been tragic. It's happened. And when it happened, it happened. It's done. But to not really experience this. So it's 8. I guess we have an hour, right? So we're done. So I'm going to finish with this. This story. There is this guy who decided to go for a walk in the morning on the beach. And as he is walking in the distance, he sees a guy who is picking something from the ground and throwing them in the ocean. And then as he approached the area, he sees a bunch of starfish, and this guy is picking up the starfish and throwing them. And he said, what are you doing? The guy said, I'm just saving these guys, throwing them. He says, what difference is it going to make? There's so many of them. So the guy picked another one and threw it in the ocean, and he said, it makes a difference to that one. So there was somebody in AA who saw me suffering. His actions made a difference in my life. Okay? His action made a difference in my life. I have a 16-year-old that I'm raising. Really sweet man. He used to fall asleep on my chest when he was little. He stopped doing that when he was 14. But those moments were so special for me. The moments I spent with my daughter growing up, reading to her, making fun of the stories as I'm telling them, making funny voices. Those are priceless moments that you guys have allowed me to live by exposing me to a program that really works. I was a hopeless drunk when I got here with you. I might not be all complete because I still am a work in progress. But I'm eternally grateful for you being here for me. That's all I have. Thank you.